What is the year of your birth?
My year of my birth,
yeah.
It's 6/6/1952.
And where did you live in the Leytonstone area? We're going back to 1984 to 1994. So.
Right, it's not as far back as 84, but I moved to 181 Grove Green Road, and that's E11 for Freddie, and I moved there in round about 1987 to 1988. I can't quite remember, sort of, because I joined Leighton Artist Group, and I was their secretary in 1988, so it must have been round about 87, 88 that I moved to 181. I was in Wanstead before that.
Right. So, how did you hear about ACME?
I phoned up Sheila Whittaker, basically, I was looking to join an artist group. I'd come back from Suffolk, and I wanted to meet a few artists, other artists in the area, in the local area. And I'd heard that there were a couple of groups, and I was given a name, it was Sheila. So I rang Sheila and joined Leighton Artist Group.
All right. So were you part of ACME? Were you an ACME artist?
Yes.
So how did you know about ACME?
Again, that's through Leighton Artist Group. My friend Jenny told me about ACME, and I rang up because I was living sort of with somebody else at 181 at the time, Julia Barton, I then phoned ACME, and then got put on their books, and so I was part of their artists then. Mm.
So can you remember that came about? Did you have to submit slides, an application form, interview or anything like that?
No, not at that time. I was recommended by Jenny, who was a friend of mine. She was in Leighton Artist Group, and I was recommended by, as I'd already joined Leighton Artist Group, they had my slides, and they put it forward on my behalf to ACME. I talked to I can't remember her name now. I talked to Roger Kite, and I think I might have met with him, but I can't quite remember. But it was mainly down to the efforts of people like Jenny and Sheila, because I was already working for the group, and you know, they'd seen my work and they'd seen my slides, and they recommended me to ACME. So, and I can't remember who else I spoke to. Greenleaf, Sarah Greenleaf, as well. Greengrass, was it Greengrass?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so when you, they offered you somewhere, did you take your first offer up, or?
It was actually the house, it was 181. I moved in there temporarily from Wanstead. I moved from Wanstead,
okay.
To 181. And then Julia Barton moved away, so I was able to take on 181.
And I suppose slightly different situation, because Julia Barton's living there already, so she'd probably done some work on the property.
I don't know about the house. The house had been condemned originally by the council, and then it'd been handed over to ACME, so, I mean, whatever work was done, I wouldn't know what work Julia had done, actually, but she might have done some work on the house, but it was in a fairly sad state, I suppose, really. It was crumbling away, in a way.
Can you sort of, like, imagine that house again, sort of go back and sort of take me through the house from the front door?
Mm-hmm. It was quite a longish sort of hall. On the first left was the studio. And when I first moved in, Julia was working. She was also sculpting, so her work, it was a through room, and that was quite a nice sized studio. So it was quite a small building, really. So, I mean, it was basically went from the front of the cottage to the back of the cottage, because it was a cottage, really. It was called Grove Cottage. And then going down the hall, you'd come into the sort of a living room downstairs, and then if you walked straight through the living room, you'd come to the kitchen, which was an extension that had been put on later, because it was a Victorian building, sort of late Victorian probably. But they the kitchen extension was put on later.
And so upstairs, how many rooms did you have?
There were two. So there was one front bedroom and one back bedroom.
And how was the place decorated?
How was it decorated? Well, fairly minimally, really. I mean, it was sort of, you know, painted, I think, by Julia, so it's fairly sort of lightish colour. The studio was painted white and with just muslin on the windows. And, you know, so you've got a very nice light in the studio, sort of nice white light. Fairly basic, really. The kitchen was fairly basic. It had an old butler sink in there, original old butler sink, and that was it. A wooden sort of draining board and, you know, very ancient gas cooker and grill. And but it did have an inside toilet, which is quite nice, because they'd made there was a bathroom and a toilet off to the right of the kitchen, which was quite nice to have something inside, because not all of them had them out inside. So felt quite lucky about that, really.
Yes. What about sort of furniture? Like, what did you do about that?
Donations from family and friends. Chairs and a table in the kitchen was donated, and most of my things were donated, really. Yeah.
And Grave Green Road, which was quite busy, wasn't it?
It was a busy road, yes. It was a busy road.
And, has it changed?
Has it changed?
Has the motorway actually had an effect on the amount of traffic down there?
It has had an effect. It does still get busy, but it's not as loud as it used to be. I used to be in the bedroom which faced the main road, and when I first lived there, it was really difficult because you'd have great big sort of lorries coming past, and the whole everything would shake and vibrate. So it was quite difficult to sleep at times, and it's a lot easier where I am now. Although it is still noisy, but it's not half as noisy as it was then before the motorway was built. It was pretty noisy, although you can still get a lot of traffic down here now.
Because you're still living in Greenmead, how has it changed? Because can you remember, were there any interesting places that you went to which are no longer here, for example?
It was a very good community feel. It was quite unusual because the whole community, that there were an awful lot of artists, visual artists. There were also filmmakers, felt makers, musicians. So there was a really good community feel between us, but also with our neighbours who might have been homeowners as well. So there was quite a wide mix at the time. The neighbours, I found my neighbours at 181, they were absolutely brilliant to me. They really looked after me, they were great. But we sort of made our own entertainment, as it were. So if anybody had a party, for example, we'd have Steve Rushton and I can't remember his name, but they were the Mosquitoes, so we'd have live music at the parties. It was just a great environment, you know. I mean, I had one birthday and about eight drummers turned up for my birthday. It was absolutely fantastic. It was magical. None of us had much money, so we'd really sort of have a good social, we'd gather socially and mix and visit one another and bring food, and you know, the music would be there and they'd be very sort of lively. There would be gatherings also at the Heathcote and the Northcote. That was pretty thriving in those days. And again, people like Joe Rodriguez would be playing music in the Heathcote, and violin and you know, excellent. But and the Northcote too was pretty lively, where people actually sort of recommended who might come in and you know, made suggestions as to what events could be held at the Northcote, and it was packed to the gills, and it's totally different now.
Right. So what? can you describe what those pubs are like now?
Well, the Heathcote is a strange one. It's sort of, it's really more of a sports oriented. It's got lots of, it's been done up several times, and it's got lots of, you know, things so you can watch football from all different angles and things like that. You know, so it's not really my kind of pub, really. Although they did used to have a good jazz club upstairs, and I used to go to that, but that, I don't know if that still exists now. The Northcote, it's almost like that sort of the sort of places you see tumbleweed sort of blowing through, because it's just got a few locals propped up against the bar, and you get more people when there is a football match, and you know, they've got their screens and things. But other than that, it's extremely sort of empty and totally lacking in atmosphere now. It used to have a great atmosphere, and everybody used to go there.
Yeah. So, like, at that time, when you first moved in, to Julia's place and made it your space as well, what, you know, did you do? Did you work full-time as an artist, or how did you support yourself?
I couldn't afford to work full-time as an artist. I had a part-time job with the borough, with Waltham Forest, and I was a play leader, so I worked in various local schools over a period of 10 years, and that sort of just about kept me together, but it gave me the physical time to actually continue with my own work. So I was very involved in that. I was also very involved with sort of promoting Leighton Artist Group and you know, trying to get grants with other members of Leighton Artist Groups from the borough so that we could put on workshops, which we did. We put on quite a few workshops over, you know, a few years. And they were very well attended, and they'd be held in the Jubilee Centre over sort of Cattle Road Bridge. And they were usually extremely well attended. They were very good. So it was I couldn't just live off what I did, no, as an artist, no.
Right, so when you worked as a play leader, was that part-time?
Or, yes.
Yeah, and then you did all the other workshops in the rest of the That's time, right. your own practice
yes.
in between?
Saturday workshops, the ones at Jubilee were on a Saturday, so... yes, and we'd have meetings, say evening meetings and whatever, to try and get the borough to sort of support us a bit, because it's the promotional stuff that cost the most, really. So we needed you know, and for materials as well. So we needed to have some money coming in for that, because the workshops were free. That was we were providing something for the borough.
So did you get a fee?
We got a fee, yes. For the workshops, we got a fee for the workshops, yeah.
And did you, was there a group of you doing those?
Mm-hmm.
Can you remember the names of the artists?
Well, Sheila Whittaker was one, Joe Rodriguez was another, Jenny, there was another. Can't remember her surname now, which is a bit bonkers, as she's my closest friend. But there are a few of us. Steve Rushton. There are quite a few. I can't remember all their names now.
A
dozen or more. There were more in our group.
So it was basically the Leighton Artist Group members.
Yes.
And you'd alternate.
Yes.
Or did you work... go down as a group?
Not all of us. There would be about three of us at a time, really. Caroline, I can't remember her name either, but we'd be a few of us who were, say, we'd work out in a meeting who would be interested in doing one workshop or another, and then we'd work as a team beforehand and get materials and just decide what we were going to do and how we were going to run the workshops, and that would be, say, sort of around about two or three artists for each workshop. Yeah.
Where did you go to? Did you say the name of the school?
No, it's a centre. It's a community centre near the Cattle Road. Yeah, it's just before you get there. Oh, another person in our group was Kath Baker for a while.
Okay, so I guess with all those people, what I can remember of their work, be quite a lot of different skills.
Yes, definitely.
Going in sculpture, painting, yes. Printmaking.
Yes, yes. Liz, I can't remember her surname either. Felt maker. She was part of Leighton Artist Group as well. I mean, some people were like the main body of the group, and then you'd get a few people coming in and leaving over the years that we were together, because we were also affiliated to the Whitechapel. So when the Whitechapel had their open, we would go on. Sort of a database with the Whitechapel, and we'd all sort of send in photographs of our work, and so that people could have a look through and see when we had the open studios. We'd open, you know, when the Whitechapel was, you know, when our other studios were opening with the Whitechapel. So we'd all that information for us would be with them. And we'd get people coming to visit. They'd have a look and see what work they wanted to see, and they'd come to visit us. So we'd get a bit of an influx of other people joining our group, just really for that period of time, so that, you know, they. I mean, you could open your studio potentially if you weren't part of any group, but it's more likely that, you know, you'd have more publicity through the Whitechapel, really, and people would be able to sort of choose, you know, who they would want to visit. Because it was quite a long road. I mean, it went into, you know, I mean, Joe was in Dyer's Hall, so you'd all the way down Grove Green Road. I mean, it's a really long road, and then you'd have Dyer's Hall Road. In 1 year, we had people coming in a coach, which was mad, because I was showing with Jenny, and I think her maiden name was Simmons then, and we had these rather stressed looking visitors from the coach. I think, you know, they've got the whole of Grove Green Road to nip in and out of all these open studios, and it was not easy. It's not,
where,
you know,
did they park the coach?
I don't know where they parked the coach. I can't imagine where they parked the coach. But we were waiting for them to all stream in, you know, but they were kind of looking at their watches in a sense, because it was such a, you know, major thing with Claremont Road and Colville and then Grove Green and Dyer's Hall, that it was a bit of a, it was a bit too much. It wasn't housed. We were all in our, had our studios in our own homes. So it was, you know, it wasn't as though everybody was in one building. It wasn't easy.
So do you know where these people from the coach came from?
Some of them came from right the other side of, you know, South London, all over the place. And they'd sort of accessed the Whitechapel's sort of, you know, information, and thought they'd want to come to see the work here, artists here, and they might have been attracted by, you know, a couple of people's work, and so they might just focus on that, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, if people came as individuals, obviously they came as individuals as well as through this organised coach trip from the Whitechapel, but so we got people from all over the place, really. It was really good. That was very positive. It was quite nerve-wracking, but it was positive experience to have people coming, and quite a unique one at the time, I think. Acme had quite a lot of housing at the time, and it was really quite good that they could come and sort of come into someone's home. It's a strange experience, but, and a studio. It was really quite interesting. It was an interesting experience.
And when you set up your own space for the show. So was you sharing in the big studio with Julia at the time, downstairs? You know, when you described...
Before Julia moved...
She moved
fairly soon after I moved in, really. She had a big project up north, and she started working on that and just used to come back periodically. And then decided she wanted to, she got a few commissions up there and decided she wanted to move up there altogether. So we kind of, you know, I was there really right from the word go, sort of on my own there. But she had got some of her work still there. So it was a while before I could actually use the studio space.
Okay.
Mainly because there was a 20-foot long figure in the studio, suspended in the studio.
I remember that.
It was a flying woman.
It was
a massive flying woman, but it was difficult to work around. It was difficult to work with. So I work in wood, or I used to work in wood, and so I would mainly, if I could, work outside, carve outside.
Okay, so you were like both sculptors working in this house.
She never worked in there really. I mean, I remember when I first moved in, I did help her with a project. It was a ceramics project, and I actually did help her with that, and a few other people helped her with that. But it was very soon after that. She wasn't there that long before she had this other big project, and that was it. She rarely came back after that.
Because in the 1988 show, we had to submit our images to her. So was she actually living there at the time?
She would have been, I think, 1988?
Yeah.
Okay, now that would make sense in 1988. But it might have been when she was toing and froing a bit. Yeah, because she really wasn't living there very much at all.
Okay.
She was a bit, but not much. So yes, if she was still in, she would have been still involved in 88, because that's when I started being the secretary for the Lakeland Artists Group. So yes, she was still involved in the organisation of it. But it was, yeah. So when I didn't actually work in that studio until we found a home for this rather large flying figure.
Because she does gardens now, sculptural gardens.
Oh, does she?
I don't know.
I didn't
know
that.
When you get a chance, have a Google search.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
She's doing quite well, and she actually looks younger now.
Really?
Than when she did then. There's a photograph.
Really?
Going back to the open studios, yes. Describe, say, the first one you did in terms of showing your own work and how you set the house up.
The first one, I think, I'm not entirely clear on it, but I'm pretty sure I shared with Jenny at 225. It was her and me and Ian. Partner Ian, so he it was us three down at hers first of all,
you, because Julia's big sculpture was in this room,
I couldn't show there.
You just decided
it would be impossible,
other people would share their studios and stuff. I didn't know people were doing that, but that's quite interesting.
I didn't have a studio to work in until that figure went, really. Mm. Yes, it was, you know, we were friends anyway, so I went down there, which was fine, it worked out fine.
So when you set up the studio show, did you think of it as like an exhibition? Did you clear the studio?
Can you
talk a bit about that? What you did.
We just cleared the whole area as much as possible. Any tools, whatever, that were there that we couldn't move, you just sort of cover up, really. And then muslin on the windows and paint the walls white. Mm. Any holes, fill the holes up, paint the walls white, and then hang the work. Jenny did drawings as well as sculpture herself. She worked with metal, so we'd have things. We use the outside area as well, so you could walk round the side of the house, and come and have a look at the outside area. So she had a couple of pieces in there, and I had a piece in there. I had that one in there.
Right, so when you talk about the outside area, do you mean like you were citing sculptural pieces?
Yes. Well, not, you know, I mean, I think Jenny's was either, one was suspended, this was suspended, because it needs light to shine through it. So that was hung up. Sorry for that. Sorry. Okay, I'm back. No, this you know, pieces were suspended, or one was on a plinth, I think.
Okay, so do you know when you did that one with Jenny? Was that like, what year was that? Was that like about round about 88 or before?
I reckon, yeah.
Because you reckon you moved in 87,
didn't you? It's either 87 or 88. I'm not entirely sure of the dates. Yeah. I can't quite.
So with the open studios, did you like organise them like every year?
No, I think it was biannual with the Whitechapel. We work in collaboration with the Whitechapel, so I think it was biannual. So it was 88, 90. 92 and 94, I think the last one was.
Okay, yeah.
So I haven't got my bits on foot to hand. But, yeah, I mean, I've got all late in artist group. I've got a little bit still left, but I wasn't part of Art East. I managed to find Art East stuff, but that I wasn't part of Art East. That was before. But anyway, yeah.
So you mentioned that you was fundraising as part of the Open Studios and also the workshops. I mean, how was that? Did you find it quite difficult or was it quite easy? What was the attitude?
It was difficult. I think Julia Barton was still part of that because she was one of the people who went to the borough. And they found it a very gruelling experience because we were a small group, but they were kind of suggesting that we weren't multicultural enough and that we should extend out to other artists' organisations, you know, sort of ethnically, sort of, you know, say, sort of Afro-Caribbean. There was an art organisation which we did try and contact. We did talk to people because they did pressurise us into doing that. I mean, you know, really, it was a fairly easy kind of flow for the group. Mm-hmm. But in order to, you know, sort of come up to what they were asking us to do, they had certain criteria which they really wanted us to fulfil. So we did try and contact, and we were sort of wrapped over the knuckles a bit because this group just weren't interested in working with us. They worked in their own way. They were specifically at that point, that's what they wanted to be, was Afro-Caribbean. They didn't really want to work with us. They had their own agenda, but the council were really trying to get us to open our door. They didn't think we had an open policy, so it was a bit of a nightmare. I mean, they came back a bit banjaxed, you know, sort of.
And did was the Afro-Caribbean group, where were they?
I can't. They were in the borough.
Yeah.
They were based in the borough. But we did try and, you know, phone them up, and they didn't phone us back. And, you know, I'd try ringing them, and they didn't respond. So we did try.
Were they an arts organisation themselves?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yes, they were.
So they had their own team of artists?
Yes. Yeah. Either musicians or visual artists. But, you know, they really did have their own agenda, and I think they wanted to keep it like that, really. But we did try.
With the children that you work with, and that time, and...
What, for the workshops?
Yeah, was it culturally diverse?
Yes, that's what we used. When I'd done, I can't remember when I did my workshop, I mean, it's all in a file somewhere, which I'll have to try and find, but I did a T-shirt dyeing workshop, because I was doing a lot of dyeing, of painting on dyes and tie-dye and all sorts of things, and I that was my skill at the time, I felt, rather than sculpture. I thought it was easier to set up, so and we had all sorts of people coming to that, and it wasn't age, we didn't, you know, age or I mean, it had no boundaries age-wise. I mean, it could be anybody, as long, I think we said, as long as they were, If they were under five, they had to be accompanied by an adult. But other than that, we were pretty flexible as to who we offered it to. And I had a whole bunch of sort of teenage Asian lads, which was brilliant. And they had very clear ideas of what they wanted to do. Because, I mean, I had managed to borrow an airbrush, and they loved that. So that's what they wanted to do, was airbrush stuff. And they really did seem to enjoy it, and that was great, because we did want to encourage as many different, you know, sort of culturally diverse parts of the community as possible. You know, we aimed to do that. We advertised in the local paper and things like that, you know, and we put flyers, zillions of flyers, in local libraries and swimming pools and things like that. So we try to get it out to as many people as we could. I mean, we produced a leaflet for the workshops and stuff.
And so you did get funding from Waltham Forest?
We did get funding for that, yes. We got funding for the workshops, really.
And any other local funders?
No.
So at that time, was it only really Waltham Forest around here?
Mm-hmm.
And could you...
Not everybody had the time. I mean, most of us were having to work in other areas, and, you know, energies, you had to put your energies elsewhere. And, I mean, we were all shattered, because, I mean, the amount of time that it took to put in a bid, blah, 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 and, you know, it's sort of really, I mean, hours and hours we spent on that.
Is there a limit to the amount of funding they had to give you then as well? Can you remember?
Oh, it would be, because it's part of the voluntary sector, so... They have a sort of a pot of money for voluntary sector groups, but at that, you know, and at that time, I mean, you did have to really sort of be very, very clear as to what the money was going to be spent on, etc. But I think we got about £2,000, something like that.
Not bad,
really, for the time. Not bad at all. And, you know, we did. I mean, the people who ran the workshops, they had going, you know, ILEA rates. For tutors, which is also quite good. I mean, nothing's ever going to cover the amount of time that you spent on the number of times you met beforehand and whatever. It's never going to cover that, but at least that we were able to cover that for the actual workshop times that people got that amount of money, you know, so it didn't feel too abused, you know. But it was hard work getting the grant application written out, and then I would be the one to type it out in that first year anyway.
And because you was a group, did they expect you to have a constitution?
We did have a constitution, yes, which is somewhere. We did, yeah, we had to have a constitution, and then obviously we had to have a voted in members of the committee, you know, so you had to voted in treasurer, and we had to have an AGM, and we had to comply with all of that, of course, yeah. So yeah.
That's really good. And you described a little bit about, you know, the community and the parties and so forth. I mean, were there any particular people that you sort of were your friends?
Yeah.
The people that you remember, the artists? You mentioned some. Could you talk a bit about...
Jenny Stevens and Ian, they were my good friends. They were at 225.
And what did they do?
Well, Jenny was a sculptor in metal, usually, also wood. Ian worked in leather. So, but they again, they couldn't sort of survive from their artwork. So he had a business, leather business, at Covent Garden, so they both used to work there at the weekends.
And what was that doing in that business? Was it making bags and things like that?
Bags, so, belts.
In Covent Garden. So was that like a stall?
Yes, with a stall. But his actual I think he went to Cordwainers or something, but his actual, he did some really interesting pieces in leather as well, which were, you know, beautifully made, quite strange sort of objects, but you know that the main his that wasn't his bread and butter. I mean, he wasn't, you know, not so many of us were really sort of selling. Few people were selling. Some people did, but there weren't that many who were actually making money at that. Steve Rushton, Sheila Whittaker, I'd sort of, you know, she's definitely a friend, I would say. And again, you know, she was having to, well, she did, she worked at a college.
And also you mentioned a felt maker.
Liz.
What was that?
Liz.
Right, what did she do? What was
can't remember.
Felt making? Just making the felt?
No, but I mean, she would make the felt and then actually sort of, you know, they'd be on a two-dimensional piece of work, really. You know, more of a relief work that she did. So that's how she worked, yeah.
And do you remember how she supported herself?
No.
Was she, again, down Grove Green Road?
She wasn't. I think she was in... Colville. She was in Colville Road. But I can't remember who else. Oh, Christine Binney was a friend. She lived in Dyers Hall Road. We're in the same studio as Grace and Perry.
Oh, yeah.
She was a friend as well.
So you used to go up there?
Yeah. So that yeah. So that was quite, you know, I mean, we kind of worked together later on, Christine and I mean, she was more of a, I think she'd done either ceramics at college or something, but she was moving more into using her body as artwork, which came out of her clubbing days.
Yeah.
And moved more into a more kind of primal kind of earth mother area of operations. So, you know, we worked together on the art house.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I you know, that was kind of somebody contacted me through Leighton Artist Group and the art house. Yeah, that's we had an exhibition. I was the person that he contacted first and then we put it to various people whether they'd like to participate, because we knew the house was going to be knocked down really, really quite suddenly.
So who wrote the text on this flyer?
This? I've no idea. I don't remember.
So there were 20 artists in that show.
That's right.
Were they Acme artists?
Some were, yeah.
And could you tell me about the...
Well, Joe Rodriguez did this deconstructed car in the front. That was him. He came along with his welding gear and cut things up.
What year are we talking about here? Can you remember?
No. It'll be sort of 94. Okay. It was right... Hang on. 13th of April, May. Doesn't have 94 on it. But, you know, Claremont Road... I moved here in 95... January 95, so it was kind of, it's got to be, it was autumn and winter of 94 when Claremont Road, when all that was happening, all the action there.
Right.
So it's got to be 94, I think. But that was, not that end, the other end of Claremont Road, and that this was due to be demolished. So that's why we had just about, well, we thought we might only have about a week.
So, who painted the outside of the house?
A few people did. A few people, but there were also people living down the road at that point who were the protesters. And there were a few people living permanently down Claremont Road then. And there was a couple of young people painted the outside. And then I don't know what I've got inside. There's Joe. That's Joe Rodriguez doing deconstructing the car. A few people did the outside, young people who were really more to do the protest. That was an archive of what Grove Green Road looked like before they started knocking it down.
Those photographs, I think, is Steve Johnson, road protesters.
Okay, yeah. I can't remember who did that. We had a few people. We had in this downstairs room, we had Grace and Perry made a pot just for the art house. Mm. Unfortunately, some visitor actually stole it, which is a shame. We had this muralist from Manchester, whose name I can't remember, but he came and did some murals. He'd heard about it. That's Grayson's pot.
So when you say someone came down to Manchester, right. Mm-hmm. How did they hear about your exhibition?
They heard about the actions at Claremont Road, and he wanted to become more involved in that. And for some reason he'd heard of Leighton Artist Group, and I was the person to ring, you see. So at the time, because I was like the studio coordinator at the time, so I was the kind of name. So he contacted me because he wanted to be part of the action. And a lot of, you know, I mean, this wasn't like and he did that as well. What was his name? I can't remember. But a lot of people were, you know, they were very, very stressed because they were having to sort of find Acme people were trying to find somewhere to live, basically. So it was very, very, I mean, this all happened in the space of, like, you know, a week or 8 days or just over.
So are you saying that Acme people had been evicted at that time, so that's why they were stressed and looking for somewhere to live?
They had eviction notices, some of them, yes, and we never knew if we were going to be there 1 week, another week, or you know, could it be extended. It was pretty hair-raising at the time, I have to say. Mm-hmm. That's Graham Miller's partner, Mary. That's her piece.
Oh, the cupboard piece with text and graphs
that's
going
it.
From shoes.
That's it. That's Mary's. This is that's another one of hers. That's Lisa Wooding, who was also part of Acme at one point.
So when you say the names and point to the photograph, mm. Can you describe in the photograph, because this is an audio.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. Well, Lisa's work was kind of a bath full of rubble with trees painted on the side of it, and then a road kind of coming, winding out of it, really. And it's got little cars all the way around the windowsill. And then Mary's work, as you say, is text, and then various objects. Walt Whitman, the words are by Walt Whitman. And that's Lisa's again. I don't know whose that is. And then there are a few, you know, other sort of young people who came in and decorated the kitchen. That's Christine Binney's. That's a room which is a completely ochre, red ochre, and gold, what's it called, that really thin stuff, the gold film fire,
gold leaf.
That's it. So they're quite, as you went out towards the outside, she had her body pressed up against the wall, her greased body, pressed by me, I have to say.
And there's some paintings, some sort of almost sort of classical looking paintings there. Was that her work as well?
No, I don't remember.
It seems to be in the same room.
Well, no, it's not in the same room. That's just the room there. Oh, these are Mary's. Those are Mary's. That's Lydia. Can't remember her name. That's right. Those are Mary's.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't see that. Yeah. And then that's her. She extended herself out into the outside laboratory, which she then gold leafed. And then mine, which doesn't look as impressive because it was taken from a height, which is a shame. But these are all teeth of flint, not a blue slate. They were quite big, but that doesn't really sort of do it justice at all. But I wanted a walkway that went up to this tree, which was sort of in bloom still, and I planted forget-me-nots all the way up to the tree. I'm a bit of a nature person, really, and I do like. It felt quite poignant that, or you know, these trees which were in bloom, that they were going to be sort of very shortly demolished as well. So I wanted this to be a more of a contemplative kind of walkway with that as the main feature, really. It can't see the forget-me-nots, unfortunately. It was all done very, very quickly. And it, you know, it's a shame there's not a better photo of that.
So how long was the art house actually open to the public
for? Well, I think we went on for quite a while. I mean, I think we went on for about 2 weeks. It wasn't bad. It wasn't bad at all, and, you know.
I'm really curious about that text that says live performance by the Demolition Crew, please, and the M11 Link campaign.
Yes, I don't know who did that. It was probably the campaign office, I would think, because they were handing a lot of these out, and they were actually sticking a few on the backs of some of the security guards as well. So I think that's where that came from. It was printed by the office, the protest office. So there are protesters on the roof there, and this is the art house. So these are the security guards and what have you. So there was a lot, and police. There was a lot of stuff going on at the time that we were, you know, getting buckets of paint and stuff like that, and bringing it round and sort of, you know, deciding what we're going to do, who's going to do that, who's going to do this, because they're all waiting to come and knock this lot down, that section down.
Right. So also I can see these posters up on the corrugated iron as you turn the street into Claremont Road. Can you talk about those?
No, I have no idea what they're about. They're just posters. I don't know who put those up. They're just commercial posters for events that people. But they're nothing to do with us. I mean, they're just people bill sticking.
So was the art house, in a sense, to do with Operation Roadblock?
I have no idea. I mean, all I know is that it became. It was also in the end, because I was working in the afternoons, I couldn't be there because to sit. And you know, I've got the key here. Where is it? That's the key. I've still got the key for the art house. Yeah, no, isn't it strange? I keep meaning to chuck it out. I think, why have I got this? But then I think, oh. But I mean, it was a symbol. It became a symbol, and we had people visiting from all over the place. And I don't know who's got the visitors book now. I really don't know whether it still exists. But we had people coming over for the protest, and who came to the art house and were just blown away by it. I mean, it's nothing special. I mean, the actual art is just like dip it in and snap it on. I mean, it's like quick decision. You had to make a quick decision because you never knew when they were going to bring in the cherry pickers to. And a demolition crew to sort of finally, knock it down. But it made television. It was so strange. There's Christopher Peacock with his sort of rather snazzy tie in the art house, but the lights were so bright. I kind of thought, oh, I'm going to have to run round and watch this at home because it'll be clearer. So I ran around the corner from where he was doing his, you know, from the art house thing, to sit and watch it on the television. It was so bizarre. It was utterly bizarre, but it was weird. It was very strange. But so he did a thing from the art house, which is amazing. And I had that's when I had all the BBC and all the television crew and all that lot. They were all parked outside my house virtually. But it was you know, so I was sort of running down the road to sort of, you know, think, oh no, it'll look better on television, you know. So it had a bit of publicity. I mean, there are probably damn sight better photographs than mine. In fact, I know there are hanging around somewhere.
Did anyone video that broadcast?
I wouldn't know.
How long did you have to set up the art house?
It was a very short space of time because it was minute by minute. We didn't know if they were going to be coming in with the riot police to come in and shove people out the way and say, you know, start demolishing, because basically they were going to get the people off the roofs and then start demolishing, and that was the end. That would be the end of it. You see, so it was. We thought we had about 8 days, but we weren't sure. But it was a symbol, really. It was a symbol of, a sense of community and and, you know, the thought of more roads and pollution and what have you. I mean, the artists weren't necessarily protesters, but we did live in this community, and we grew roots in this community. And it was really a moving experience for us to know that our houses were going to be knocked down.
So the art house, do you know who used to live in there?
I can't remember who lived in the art house. I don't know, because there'd be people living down Claremont Road for years, you know. I don't know who actually lived there before.
So at that time, can you describe what Claremont Road was like?
Well, at that time?
Yeah.
Well, at that time, there was quite a lot going on down there. I mean, you had people coming from all over the world, really, as protesters. They weren't locals so much. I mean, the locals had fought hard and long for years, since the 60s really, and got absolutely nowhere. They used to have their weekly meetings in a church hall in St Mary's Church, I think. And
is that on
Leighton Highway? Yes. And got absolutely nowhere. So by this time, there was a certain amount of publicity and sort of interest from outside, and so it kind of got lots of sort of young crusties arriving and people who were hardened campaigners and all sorts. And I mean, so we certainly weren't part of that, but we were linked to the whole idea, and a lot of us were against the road purely because it would cut a community in half, we felt. And so we wanted to be part of that. So we would kind of visit the art. I mean, I was part of the art house. Christine Binney was part of the art house, and a few of us artists. But in general, we would kind of go to visit, because there were all sorts of things being done in Claremont Road which were nothing to do with us, but were really quite bizarre and interesting. I mean, they set up a bike shop and a cafe and
Bike shop I've never heard of. Could you talk about that?
I don't. I mean, I only know that there was somebody called Old Mick or something, and he was to do with the bike shop, and people could go
Mick
there.
Roberts?
I'm not sure what his surname was, but we called him Old Mick, and he lived down Claremont Road, and it was him and somebody else, some little bearded person, long white beard. Remember him? And they used to run the. They set up this bike shop for, you know, repairing bikes and stuff like that, which is quite interesting. And then the cafe was amazing. And, you know, it wasn't something that we'd done, but I think a lot of us who were still there, the artists who were still remaining at that time, which is in 94, and a lot of people had left by then, I mean, you know, parts of Dyer's Hall had been knocked down already and what have you, so there'd already been some demolition going on, so a lot of people had left. But the people who were left, we were kind of on the periphery, but we did used to visit, and they used to have their Sunday afternoon jazz for staff, which is really good. Sunday afternoon, it was really, really good. It was fun, you know,
so that
jazz in the afternoon.
Could you describe the street and also the cafe, like what it would be like? Say you was taking someone down that street.
Oh, I mean, I haven't got all my photos. I can't remember
just
any.
Just from your memory.
Well, I mean, it was just various things. I mean, it kind of grew. The various sort of things that people would bring, and there'd be furniture in the middle of the road and stuff like that, and people would make fires and stuff. They started to put things in the trees, netting and build tree houses and things like that, you know. They were. I know from the houses themselves that they were beginning to create places where they would be difficult to get to. These are the protesters, you know, lock-ons would be found, and, you know, after an action in the street, you wonder what that was. So I mean, you know, there was a variety of things. I mean, they painted the whole road. That the if only I could remember his name. I'm terrible short-term memory. I'd have to write it down. But he organised it with these young people to paint all the flowers and things down the whole block down
so
Claremont Road.
So was that a protester organised that?
No. Well, he was. I mean, he was a muralist.
Okay.
So he actually started that process, and then a few of the youngsters who were protesting and living down Claremont Road, they sort of carried it on, basically. There, I think down the other end, was it John? There was something going on that was still to do with his filming and things like that. John Smith, there was something to do with him.
What do you mean something to do with
him? I can't remember. It was to do with the windows. It was to do with the...
Oh, a house that you meant.
So there was still there evidence from those days, even though the protesters had done all different sorts of things.
So do you mean... Like House Watch was still showing that down there in 94?
Not the film, but I think there was something painted on the windows, from what I can remember. If I'm remembering it right.
Do you know what was painted on the
windows? No, I can't remember. It looked like figures. I just can't remember. That's very hazy. It's just a sort of peripheral memory, really.
That you think John Smith did.
He might not have. It might have been protesters who'd seen his house watch thing, and they'd decided to do that. Yeah, I don't think it would have been his. No, but I can't remember. It's just like really kind of hazy and vaguely remember it.
Can you remember the house watch event down Claremont Road and roughly what year that was?
It was earlier than 94. It was about 92 or something like that. It might have been earlier even, possibly. I can't quite recall because I didn't... I mean, I vaguely remember seeing some of it, but I was always working at the weekends at Covent Garden myself, so I didn't get to go to the street parties, which, you know, I was always working.
But what do you remember about the house watch that you did see?
Well, it was just a kind of a just on a loop. There was a film showing all the time, just a couple of scenes. And like there was a couple in a car, which was on a loop.
And where was that projected?
Well, that was in the car. That was in the car, and then there's one inside the house.
Oh, okay. So like it was projected on the windows of the car and the windows of the house?
Yes, yeah. So it was effective, it was good. I mean, that when everything else, you know, when I came back home, that was still doing that, you know. Mm. So, I mean, that was quite, you know, effective, really.
Yeah. And you mentioned the cafe. Can you describe that?
No.
Did you ever go there?
Yes, but I mean, it's just a cafe, really. You know, I mean, it was a cafe. I mean, they did it quite nicely. I mean, it was, you know, fairly kind of derelict. But I mean, with the protesters, they often had quite a lot of skills, like building skills and stuff like that. So they were able to, you know, not just knock things out like some of the artists had done, and then possibly the house might possibly fall down, as has happened with my friend's house down the road because of the person who was there before, Dougie, who removed a beam. They actually knew what they were doing building wise, and so when they created a space, it was actually safe. And so, you know, it was done up really nicely, and most of their stuff had come out of skips. They were extremely good at skipping, and you know, they'd have flowers on the table and stuff like that. I mean, I only went there about twice, I think. You know, I was just amazed at how quickly something could be created like that. That was one of the positive things, was that there was all this destruction going on around, and yet there was a lot of creation as well going on around. So it was really interesting to see how something could be made out of absolutely nothing, and it needed to be done in a very disempowering environment at the time. There was nothing that anybody could really do. People were being filmed by, I was as well, and taking photographs of in my own garden along the railway track. There were people with, you know, trained on me, and I was really angry about that. And, you know, saying, you know, people were sort of, they didn't know for sure, but it was either the police themselves or the transport police, or people said Pinkerton's detectives were involved as well. And I mean, we were just Acme people, and you know, I'd sort of look out of my window, you know, and there'd be somebody snapping away with a big old telephoto lens.
How did that make you feel?
Well, I'm infuriated, and I, you know, I did used to sort of go down and sort of tell them what I thought of them.
So they didn't intimidate you, because that was probably the intention.
It made me angry more so. It made me angry, but then, you know, I didn't particularly want to feel that angry for so, you know, for so long, mm-hmm. really. And it really kind of made me more susceptible to viruses and being ill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by the time I moved to this house, I was absolutely covered in, I couldn't bend my fingers. I had sort of adult eczema, and I couldn't even go like that without my skin sort of cracking. I mean, it had a really deleterious physical sort of effect on me, all of that, you know, really.
So, I mean, not knowing what was going to happen.
Not knowing, seeing the fabric of society, how it can break down everything, you know. I mean, it's nothing like a war zone, but there were certain similarities. Say, you know, when rats were running around all over the place, and, you know, and a lot of people complained about that, and I had a rat sort of in 181 sort of trying to sort of claw its way through. Gnaw its way up into my kitchen. It was extremely nerve-wracking, and it's not something you normally experience. And just it did seem like it was as the houses were being demolished, that the fabric of society that we all kind of have got so used to being in place has all been kind of, you know, disintegrating along with it. And it's, you know, and I took photographs of houses that were the inside of houses where people once lived. And there's this kind of, it's a bit ghoulish, but it's this like kind of, you're almost attracted to this sort of thing, you know, where people once lived, and now it's nothing. With, you know, it was very brutal, really. And I think that the small things that we did, like the art house or what happened down Claremont Road, it was really sort of the few little bits of sort of empowerment. And just trying to keep it going, because you realise that the state, how big the state is, and how you don't have a chance, you don't have a say really. You know, you might, but then you're you really don't have a say, because by the time they'd had a few sort of crusties up a few poles and stuff like that on the television, they were absolutely determined to make that into a motorway, come hell or high water. I mean, what good it's done, God knows, because they said it was going to relieve the traffic down Leytonstone High Road, which, of course, it hasn't, not a jot.
Yeah.
Hasn't relieved local traffic problems one iota, but it has increased the air pollution around here and the noise pollution, of course. But, you know.
You mentioned that you lived in Wanstead before you moved
yes.
here. Did you go back to Wanstead when the protests were happening about
June? I was there. But not at the time when the tree was cut down. No, I couldn't take part in everything. A friend of mine, she was there, but I couldn't go there. I was working every afternoon. I did go round there for a vigil before the tree was demolished. That was quite a quiet vigil. We had a bit of a meditation round the tree, and a few of us were there for that. And it's quite quiet at the time. But they, you know, at that point, they were sending mail to the tree, and the postman would deliver to the tree. It's really great. I mean, the community, fantastic.